REM celebrates 25 years of the award-winning album Automatic for the People.
Smash, smash, crack, push, whack, tie another one to the racks, baby.
This landmark album reissue features a new mix by producer Scott Litt and a four-disc deluxe edition, which includes 20 never-before-heard demos, including the mythical last track, Devil Rides Backwards, and Mike's pop song.
Night swimming deserves a quiet night. I'm not sure all these people understand.
REM celebrate the 25th anniversary of Automatic for the People. For more information and to pre-order, visit youdiscovermusic.com.
The kind of remarkable thing is that as a group, you could keep the same vision and the same desire to work together. Peter and Mike said very early on in 1981, I think, these are the things we need to be careful of if we want to continue doing this. The things that break up bands basically boil down to two reasons, ego and money.
The band formed in Athens, Georgia in 1980. Going on to sell 85 million records worldwide, they became one of the biggest selling acts of all time.
For those records, we were the right band in the right place at the right time. The world was ready for us, the musical world, the political world, the listening world was ready for us, and we were ready to be that band.
More than three decades and 15 studio albums, the group announced its breakup in 2011.
We enter into the orbit of pop culture in the U.S., certainly from time to time, but any attempt at moving along with whatever trend or fad is happening at the moment would never be an option for us.
When your day is long.
I'm Pete Mitchell, and this is the story of REM. REM were one of the most influential, prolific, and important American groups of all time. Michael Stipe, Peter Buck, Mick Mills and Bill Berry began their humble post-punk beginnings in the college town of Athens, Georgia. Their first performance was playing at a friend's birthday party in an abandoned church on April the 5th, 1980. By the early 1990s, they were a global phenomenon. Playing regularly around town, they would refine their live work and began to develop their songwriting skills. The first notable recording was an early version of Radio Free Europe. Produced by Mitch Easter, who had worked with the band until Reckoning, the song was released as their debut single in 1981. The song was pivotal. Selling around 2,000 copies worldwide, college radio and the club scene embraced the band, giving them the impetus to continue. Their first 45 is still one of their proudest moments. Here is Mick Mills.
You know, we love 45s. I mean, especially Peter and I, you know, as kids growing up, we had tons of 45s. So be able to put one out, for me, that was a pinnacle of the career.
Here is Michael Stipe.
Vinyl to hand.
Coming out, transfer, coming out, transfer,
Almost instantly, the band became the darlings of the alternative music press. Early support came from a new wave rock magazine, giving the band their first piece of national press.
The very first thing was Crib Death in the New York Rocker. I don't know why I remember that. But
Crib Death.
Can you believe it? There was a really cool sort of underground music mag from New York called New York Rocker, and the guy had a column where he found these really hard to find, just the first 45s by people wherever he could find them, and it was called Crib Death, and he gave us a really nice review.
Do you get a 9 out of 10? 3-star?
I don't remember exactly what his rating system. I think the fact that he wrote about it at all was his rating. I mean, if he chose you to write about, that was your 10-star.
To the band's astonishment, the Village Voice, the left-leaning independent weekly New York newspaper, voted Radio Free Europe as their single of the year. Here is Michael Stein.
The Village Voice is kind of the reason that I became interested in CBGBs and the punk rock scene in the first place. So for them to throw us a little shout out meant the world to me. I was 21 years old.
First single, which was Radio Free Europe and Sitting Still, was, you know, we put it out for 5 cents. When that was picked up by the Village Voice as the single of the year, or the indie single of the year, whatever they called it in 1981, we were sellouts. And we've been sellouts since the very beginning, so we weren't really listening to the people that were claiming that their, quote, punk ethic was more indie than ours.
After the minor success of the group's debut, they spent a weekend at Mitch Easter's drive-in studios recording the Chronic Town EP, which topped the EP charts, selling 44,000 copies in 1982. It would be the gateway to their first critically acclaimed album. In May of 1983, the band released Murmur, the album that invented alternative rock. Has been described as one of the greatest debuts of all time. The long player was full of ringing guitars, mystery and darkness that set them apart from their peers. Here is Mick Mills.
But it didn't sound strange to us, you know. It made perfect musical sense what we were doing. Up against what was popular at the time, it probably did sound very strange or certainly unusual. But we were far too stubborn to be swept away by anything. We weren't going anywhere.
Put your hair back. You get to leave. 11 gallows on your sleeve.
Murmur crept into the Billboard Top 40 and the re-recorded and re-released Radio Free Europe, hitting the top 30 on the mainstream rock chart. Further evidence of the growing critical and commercial success of the group was compounded by the Rolling Stone magazine end-of-year critics poll.
Jackson's Thriller, you know, we were no richer for it. We were still in the crappy van that we were driving around in for 5 years, but it was kind of, you know, it was kind of a surprise. So the surprises that came later were not expected or anticipated or anything that we had set as goals, but each of them were really nice.
It speaks to their credibility, I think, that they did that.
We were blindsided by it. I can say that. We had no idea that that was going to happen.
Beyond unexpected.
And the record had gotten really good reviews basically everywhere, but it was really, really, really unexpected. I think number three was U2, Joshua Tree.
Whatever it meant to us, I think it meant more to other people in the sense that, whoa, here's this band that I may have heard of or I may not even be aware of, but if somebody thinks they're better than Thriller, then maybe I should go out and give them a shot. So, you know, I think it helped us a lot to have that happen.
I think there was a degree of them trying to establish credibility as a journalistic, you know, music loving magazine. Thriller, looking back at it now, it is an amazing accomplishment. I thought it was very mainstream, and I think most people thought it was very mainstream to the point of being a little bit cheesy. And so for Rolling Stone to choose this unknown band out of Athens, Georgia.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I mentioned earlier the Los Angeles Times just named this album one of the five best released so far in 1983. It's called Murmur. It's by a group of gentlemen from Athens, Georgia, called REM, and we're happy to have them making their national television debut with us tonight. Please welcome REM.
Did you never call?
Their second album, Reckoning, was released in 1984. It was an eminently worthy successor to Murmur and was an important building block to international success. Full of accomplished and intriguing songwriting, it had more of a wider appeal than their debut.
We were getting to know each other better as musicians. I think we were feeding off each other as we wrote songs together.
I figured out what sound the bass guitar made versus what sound the guitar made. I didn't know until we recorded Reckoning. Could identify one from the other because one had four fat strings. But I did not know that the bass did the low notes and the guitar did the high notes.
Well, Michael, it was all a learning curve.
It was a learning curve, and that's a significant point. I think that alongside that, and following on your last comment about Murmur, we were trying desperately to follow a record that had been voted number one by Rolling Stone magazine over Michael Jackson's Thriller. And with the encyclopedic musical knowledge that Mike and Peter and Bill had, we were trying to avoid sophomore jinx. So we wrote and recorded Reckoning as quickly as possible. I think we did it in 11 days.
That was a great time. You've got four or five guys traveling in a van playing shows all over the Southeast. What could be better?
Through their constant touring, the band had captured something spontaneous and energetic on their second album.
Well, we were playing so much live. We were touring so frequently and so for so long that we figured, you know, why fight against that? Let's go ahead and record the record in kind of that same spirit. So we did it as quickly and as, you know, one or two takes and that sort of thing, and just get in there and get it done and get out and capture what we were. Since what we were was really happening and really exciting and working for people, we said, let's just go ahead and make this record reflect that.
The album would climb to number 27 on the Billboard chart, and a review by New Musical Express described them as one of the most beautifully exciting groups on the planet. By 1985, REM were midway through one of their most productive periods. Their third album, Fables of Reconstruction, was a difficult record to make. To add to the challenge, they decided to record in the UK with a new producer, Joe Boyd. He had previously worked with the likes of Nick Drake, Pink Floyd, Fairport Convention, and 10,000 Maniacs.
We had a tough time making a record.
Yeah.
That comes out in the music. Artistically, I was trying to stretch beyond what I had done with Murmur and Reckoning, which was to kind of write lyrics that didn't necessarily have to make sense. And I realized that I'd reached the end of that, that I couldn't do that. Okay. Other people did it really beautifully. Elizabeth Fraser went and made a career of singing nonsense. Jonesy from the Icelandic band Sigur Rós did the same, but I had reached the end of that. And so I was really struggling artistically and personally, privately, in every possible way.
Not the bitch. Still, not the bitch. Still,
great record. It has great songs on it. Anytime you have a song with great records, it's going to have, I mean, a record with great songs, it's going to have some certain quality to it. It was a weird little studio, and it was, you know, it was a weird little time to be in London. It was very removed from everything we'd ever known. It was literally as foreign a place as we'd spend any time in. So, you know, this combination of things just made it sound and feel very different. Joe Boyd was a different kind of producer. You know, he'd come from a folk background. I mean, I love Joe. I consider him a friend, and he's a great producer. And I think he did a great job on the record. It was just a very odd time.
On my first attempt at narrative as the lyricist, but it was winter time. We were dirt poor. It was winter in Georgia, but we had heaters that worked, and we came here and it was just incredibly miserable, cold. It was a dark time anyway, so that didn't make it much easier. And on top of that, we had our commute to the studio was 45 minutes by tube to North London, and the studio wasn't well heated either. I mean, of course, spending 2 or 3 months in London would be incredible over spending 2 or 3 months in Athens, Georgia, but I didn't expect it to be as cold as it was, and it was really cold.
Joe walking me around London and telling me about the art scene in the 1960s and how he met Yoko Ono and who she was before she met John, and then at one point introducing me to Grace Jones. And she had a hat the size of this table that kind of blocked the sun. It was a really amazing meeting. But he was a great guy, and he was a great producer, and a lot has been said, and it goes through the sausage grinder of mythology and comes out the other end something that it didn't quite really resemble. It was dark and it was hard, but it was just our third album.
Celebrating 25 years of Automatic for the People, the story of REM continues very soon. For more information and to pre-order, visit youdiscovermusic.com.